Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, to the Donaldson Files here on the Bachelor News Radio Network. Dr. Larry will be joining me in about 15 minutes. We're going to look at his career, his life, and the lessons he's learned from his business, from working with government, from as an educator, and as a owner of a horse farm. So he'll be on in about 10 minutes. But what I wanted to kind of do is get started here with this is a couple of things. A couple of things. Basically, I'm going into the sports. The first part of this is the sports. And then I walked in very briefly to talk about the Canadian election last night. But the first thing I want to talk about is last night the Packers beat up on the Detroit Lions. And this kind of shows you in the NFL and football in general how one week can change everything. Last week, the Packers got defeated badly. It was, you know, they looked horrible. And then, you know, Aaron Rodgers, being Aaron Rodgers, when they said, well, what's going on? What's going on? His answer was, it's one game. We got 16 more games left. Don't worry. We'll take care of this. And last night, the second half, he looked like Aaron Rodgers. You know, they were down 17-14 to half, and after that it was like 21 straight points. They dominated the game. And it kind of gives you, now we'll see what happens next week. But here's the point. I mean, it's like drama. You know, there's, you know, so much drama here, you know, in the NFL. One game doesn't make a season. And that's what Aaron Rodgers' point was. But there is a lesson to be learned in this, and this is the lesson that I'm going to get here, and we're going to do some lessons on sports in general, but this is the lesson that I'm going to leave with this audience, is this, okay? Sometimes in life, things aren't always what they seem, or the things aren't as bad as they appear, or they may not be as good as they appear, or sometimes, you know, what happens today or this week or tomorrow, well, you know, a month down the road, the whole thing changes. This is life. This is politics. This is sports. You know, how many times have you, let's say, you've had a day, you know, something that happened in your life, and you just felt like, you know, the lowest low, but just somehow another month later, another break comes up, and you're back on top. Sports is like that. Politics is like that. You know, political seasons changes. I mean, as somebody who's a political operative, and I do run a political PAC, America's PAC, you know, it's like the highs and the lows. It's like, okay, right now, you know, somebody was to say, if the election was held tomorrow, the Republicans win. The election easy. We just did a couple of polls in a couple of battleground states where, but the question comes into play is very simple. Well, the election is not going to be held tomorrow. It's not going to be held in November of 2020. It's going to be held in 2022. So you don't know ever what's going to happen. And I think, you know, the lesson to be learned from Aaron Rodgers is that, you know, is don't panic. We still have 16 games left. You know, 16 games left. Let's say, all right, so let's not panic. So I thought that was an interesting aspect. And the other aspect comes into play is this. In a season, a play can determine where you're at. The Washington-New York Giants game was a very interesting aspect because here's the deal. The Giants left points on the field. They had one drop pass that should have been a touchdown. They end up with a field goal. They had a touchdown run It was called back because of a holding. They end up with a field goal. That's a plus 8 points they left on. And on top of that, Washington, the last play of the game, misses a 48-yard field goal. The Giants, one of the Giants' defensive linemen was offsides, lined up offside. Washington gets a second shot, wins the game. And sometimes these may be the things that determine a season. And it certainly will determine where you are right now. The Giants would have looked good 1-1. Washington would have been in a panic situation 0-2 going into the third week playing the Buffalo Bills. As it is, the Washington defense, which is supposed to be their strength, got shredded. They got shredded by Justin Herbert of the Los Angeles Chargers, and they got shredded by Daniel Jones, who before this game was 4-0 as a starter against the Washington football team. When they were named the Redskins, he won. When they were named the football team, he won. 4-0. In fact, half of his victories as a starter are against Washington. Somehow or another, the Washington defense has managed to make this guy look like a Hall of Famer. When he plays Washington, he's a Hall of Famer. When he plays the rest of the league, questionable. But you get the – but sometimes it's an interesting aspect because this was a game they should have won, and they gave the game away. And the question will come back, and certainly in the case of Washington, they have a tough schedule, and they're getting ready to play yet another playoff team from last year, the Buffalo Bills, who have a very good quarterback in Josh Allen, and by the way, who had a nice game last Sunday. So, the fate of Washington. So the fate of Washington going into the season. This was one of those games where they needed this more than the Giants, in the sense that they can't, they have to win games like this for the rest of the year. If you have a game you need to win, this is that game. Because they got a tough schedule. They got to play Green Bay with Aaron Rodgers. They got to play the Chiefs. They got to play Buffalo, just to name your three teams. Oh, yeah, and they also have to play the Tampa Bay Buccaneers with Tom Brady. So this is a schedule that you can't afford too many mistakes. Plus, the Dallas Cowboys look like they're playing well. Well, you get the point. Or maybe the point would be of this. Sometimes I see things, the second lesson of life in sports here is this. Sometimes a little thing is a difference between winning and losing. In the battle of Midway, five minutes out of an entire battle determined the fate of the Japanese Navy and the Pacific War in World War II. The Japanese fleet had already bombed the Midway Island. They now realized that the American carriers are out there. The first American wave failed miserably, didn't hit anything. But the second wave, it purified while the Japanese Navy is getting ready to change over to attack the aircraft carrier, a second wave hits. In a period of 5 minutes, three of the four aircraft carriers, the Japanese, are destroyed. The fourth one will be destroyed later. And the fate of the Japanese Navy, which landed to win that game, is basically based on one guy lining up incorrectly in the neutral zone, putting a couple of inches there, and the entire game changes. Giants go home the winner. We're going to talk very briefly about the Canadian election shortly after these breaks. This is Tom Donaldson, Donaldson Files on the Bachelor News Radio.
Every day I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. Every day I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. I start laundry at 8. At 10, we go for a walk. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m.
For those dealing with the daily struggles of caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community with experts and other caregivers for advice, tips, and support. Together, let's help each other better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
A boy born in Joplin, Missouri was fascinated by anything with wheels and a motor. The odds of him going on to fascinate millions with his talent? 1 in 260,000. The odds of this born racer having 157 career top 10 finishes in NASCAR? 1 in 125 billion. But every driver seeks the pinnacle of their achievements. The odds of him winning both the Daytona 500 and the Brickyard 400 in the same year? 1 in 195 million. The odds of a child being diagnosed with autism? 1 in 88. I'm NASCAR driver Jamie McMurray, and my niece has autism. Learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Since Buffalo Wild Wings is always open late, here are a few things you'll enjoy. Buzzer beaters, wings in 21 signature sauces and seasonings, and great deals on food and beer. Grab select domestic draft beers starting at $4. $4 shareables like street tacos, fried pickles, chili queso dip, mozzarella sticks, and roasted garlic mushrooms, and deals on select liquor and house cocktails. Phew, that's a mouthful. Catch all of the late night action. Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports. Offers and participation vary. Please drink responsibly. Void where prohibited.
Yeah, ladies and gentlemen, don't forget, you can listen to this show 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, every day on the bastardnews.airtime.pro. You want to call in tonight? 646-929-0130. And don't forget, we'll be followed on this network by You and the Law tonight at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And on the line, as I promised, Dr. Larry. Dr. Larry, how you doing?
I'm doing just great.
Well, good. I brought you on the show, but you know, I brought you on the show, not so much to talk politics per se, but you're a guy who's had a lot of experiences in different ways, and I wanted to kind of, you know, have you talk about, you know, your successes, the lessons you've learned throughout your life in the different various you know, things you've done. First of all, Noah, you're a businessman, so. Tell us a little bit about the businesses you've been involved in.
my first serious business adventure was peddling papers when I was a kid. I was a dean, and then I started a college in Kansas City, and while I was doing that, and it turned out to be really very, very, very unorthodox, but very successful. The rest of the college was not very successful, and they had been a Presbyterian college by choice, and the current president of the main campus had been he had decided to make a deal with the reorganized Latter-day Saints, and they would then take over the that campus. And so then the question was, what would happen to my campus? Because we were actually doing pretty well, and he was in the mother college was in deep trouble, and so I kind of stretched my wings and tried to survive. Actually, it turned out that one of my best friends on the board was Dr. Carl Menninger. I don't know if you remember him. He was he was called the father of psychiatry.
Topeka, Kansas.
Yeah, Topeka, Kansas, exactly. And
His
wife was on the board of the old of the other college, so they called me and asked me what they should do, and so I said, well, and I had what they really wanted was me to take over the main campus and see if I could pull it out. And I'd been fighting that. I fought that battle about 2 years before I went and started my own college. And so I really didn't feel that I could give it I didn't see how it could be done and keep my own college going. So I told them, you know, you're going to have to, I think you're going to have to give in. Of course, they were staunch Presbyterians. So that's how, then the Latter-day Saints came in, and the first thing they wanted to do was to take over my campus, and I said, well, you know, I don't think that's a very good solution to your problems. And all they could see was the cash that was coming in. I was actually making money, and you know, you don't do that very often in the academic world, especially the nonprofit world. But they then made executed a sort of a coup d'etat over the both colleges, and I really couldn't stay there, so I was getting calls from various people to do various things because it was known that I was at odds with the. I mean, here I am, you know, a poor little old Catholic in a Mormon situation. It was not very. It was just not a very good fit. So, I got a call from Baltimore from a guy whose tenure I had denied. So I don't know exactly how that happened, but he recommended me anyway for a job with Controlled Data. And so I called the guy he told me to call, and he said, where are you now? I said, Kansas City, Missouri. He said, can you be here tomorrow at 1 o'clock. I said, where? He said, Baltimore. I said, well, okay, let's try it. So I got into a flight, and by George, I made it. It was almost, my wife couldn't figure out what was going on. But that's how I got into business. And it turned out that they were trying to field the first real computer-assisted instruction package called Plato, and they were looking for academics who could actually help them introduce this to the academic community. And so I had the interview with a guy, and he was the senior vice president. So he said, well, we talked for a while, and they found out kind of some things that I'd done, and he had this other guy, Armstrong, was telling him all the time how great I was. So then all of a sudden he stops asking me questions. He says, well, when can you start? I said, well, I think I'm I don't know exactly. I'm pretty pretty loose right now. He said, "How about tomorrow morning?" I said, "Well, I don't know if I can do that. I mean, I've got a family in Kansas City, and I've got." He said, "Well," he said, "how about noon? And if you can't start first thing in the morning," so I said, "Okay, I'll tell you what. If my wife goes along with it, I'll stay until the weekend anyway, and then we'll get going." So that's how I got into it. And then it turned out that we were supposed to have partners. There was supposed to be what they called an academic and a businessman to put these learning centers together. And they wanted to put the learning centers into cities, and then they really wanted to put them into colleges and high schools. And so I had a business. I was considered an academic, so I had a business partner, and he was supposed to take care of all the hard stuff. I was supposed to demonstrate the product and tell people how they could use it and help them get it started, market support kind of stuff. And so I spent, this guy's name was Earl, and I spent about two days with Earl, and then suddenly Earl wasn't around anymore. And by this time I had to go to Minneapolis instead of Baltimore. And so after 2 days of no Earl, I finally asked somebody, "Where's Earl?" And they said, "Well, he resigned." So I said, "Oh, really?" I said, "Well, who's going to take his place?" "Well, we don't have anybody to take his place. I think you can do the whole job?" Well, I said, "I guess I'll try." And, I've never said no yet. And it turned out I did pretty well. I placed the first. Then they gave me Cleveland, Ohio as my headquarters, and so that was okay. Except that number one, they started treating me as a sales support guy who went to all of their big accounts. They went to Caterpillar and to. Two or three big communications companies, and they kept calling me off of my job to go and support these guys. And so I really ended up going all over, including Europe, and yet I was supposed to be making money in Cleveland. So I decided that wasn't going to work too well. So I made friends with the institute. Columbus, Ohio, with the guys that had created the Xerox technology, and they were considered the bleeding edge of technology. So I talked to the head of technology into starting his own learning center right there in the institute, and that was the first one that anybody ever has sold. And so on the basis of that, they decided that I needed to get into international marketing, and they were running a string of schools for computer programmers. And so I got on the I became the director of international projects. And that meant that I had to take all these foreign assignments, but I was also on the personal. Bill Norris was the founder and the guy that had a lot of the. He was the guy that ran Control Data with an iron fist. And I.
We
got to take a break, haven't we?
We got to take a quick break here. It's Tom Dawson, Dawson Files here with Dr. Larry, and we're going to follow up when we come back. I'm going to kind of ask you some questions first on the lessons you learned from running a college and doing that, as well as other lessons, because it sounds like there's like five or six life lessons I can see right here, right now. Tom Donaldson, Donaldson Files here on the Bachelor News Radio Network.
Napa know-how.
A Napa guy knows not to judge a man by his car's multicolored paint job or absence of modern gadgetry. Who cares if it's technically old enough to vote and the windows are powered by the strength of your left arm? Your monthly payment is zero, and it'll stay that way. Because with over 500,000 parts and a little Napa know-how, you can keep anything on the road. She may not be pretty, but she's all yours. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how.
Yeah, Napa know-how, ladies and gentlemen, if you need to come your cars, and also if you need to be entertained on the sports world and have a, just a nice place to have a couple of drinks and a couple of shakes and see all the football games you ever want to see.
Since Buffalo Wild Wings is always open late, here are a few things you'll enjoy. Buzzer beaters, wings in 21 signature sauces and seasonings, and great deals on food and beer. Grab select domestic draft beers starting at $4. $4 shareables like street tacos, fried pickles, chili queso dip, mozzarella sticks, and roasted garlic mushrooms, and deals on select liquor and house cocktails. Phew, that's a mouthful. Catch all of the late night action. Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports. Offers and participation vary. Please drink responsibly. Void where prohibited.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, here we're back here, the Donaldson Files and the Bachelor News Radio Network. And we also, again, if you want to listen to this show and other great shows, you go to the following, thebachelornews.airtime.pro, thebachelornews.airtime.pro. And you can get a listen to this show anytime on twice a day, for example, at 10 a.m. and 3 p.m. East, 3 p.m. every day, pardon me, 3 p.m., 10 a.m. and 3 p.m., sorry, I'm going to, every day, we get the Donaldson Files, and also the Donaldson Files is will be followed on our schedule, the Bachelor News Radio Network, by the Bachelor News Radio Network, as well as You and the Law. So 3 p.m. Central Time, 10 a.m. Central Time, every day, Donaldson Files, on the BachelorNews.airtime.pro, here in the Bachelor News Radio Network. We're back talking with Dr. Larry. Okay, here's the first of all, number one, lesson one, you know, listening to your story is, first of all, why was your portion of the college a success and everybody else? You know, what did they not do that you were doing to make your side a success?
Well, it was the financial model, basically, and I had some advantages. I went to that school as a vice president and dean of the college, and before very long, I ended up having to take over fundraising as well. So in that role, I went out to get some federal money because there were a lot of federal programs that I thought, you know, would be possible, and I'd never done that before, but I decided to try it, and I scored, and I got about $3 million from the Department of Education, which was kind of a surprise to me and everybody else, but nevertheless, that gave me a good start, and then because of that kind of funding, I was able to do some experimenting, and it turned out that I developed a whole new pattern of the business model was basically that we didn't have any classes, and it was sort of modeled more on the Oxford model of having some seminars, seminars and a lot of individual work, and we teamed people up with the people in the community, and so we saved a lot of money on faculty to begin with, and then I just hired professors from the various colleges and universities around town to sit on the boards for granting the degrees, And so I didn't have to pay, you know, any tenure or any of that. So it turned out that, and then I just had a one blank amount of money that everybody paid the same amount for each year, and that was our budget. So we just lived within it. And so when the money from the feds ran out, we had a profitable operation going. So the seed money gave us, no question about it, gave us a chance to experiment, and that's how we made money. But
okay, let me I want to pause on this because you kind of make a very interesting, because you use a totally different model than what we see in a typical college seminars, in effect. So now, is this in the classroom? Yeah. So basically, you were using a totally different aspect of teaching. That's number one. Number two, you pretty much had a limited number of professors. And so maybe the question I'm going to throw back to you is, okay, you look at today's college scenes, you know, are we over-flooded with college professor administrative staff that inflates the price of colleges? And how would your model work today if one was to incorporate it through the majority of colleges? Or could it work today? Go ahead.
Well, it would work very well because I had very, very few full-time faculty. I mean, I didn't have any real full-time faculty. What I did is I had a cadre of what I called academic advisors. And they were faculty qualified people with doctorates and publications and so on, but they didn't go to class, and they didn't, and my overhead was way, each one of them carried a load of maybe 15, 20, sometimes more students, because, you know, the students were, you had to be 25 to get in. So I didn't have any kids coming out of high school. And then I also had a lot of almost all of the students had to work with either their own company or some other venture that was pretty much associated with the expert in the community. Well, for example, I had a woman that was interested in oral history, so I put her in touch with the oral history professor or at the head of oral history at the Truman Library, which is in Independence, Missouri, which is just, you know, a few miles from Kansas City. And so she worked with him, and, you know, I asked if he would, you know, I told him we'd pay you a stipend, and he said, oh no, I already have a job, and I already get paid, and I consider this part of my job. So I got a full professor for nothing. And the same way, I had another girl that was interested in in management at Hallmark, and so I made a deal with her supervisor. First of all, I would not let anybody that worked in a company to have their boss, their direct report as their major professor. That's too much leverage. So I usually had the boss's boss as the guy that was their major professor. So she worked for the senior vice president for industrial planning, and ended up became a major player in the company after she graduated. So I mean that. Then I had another one that wanted to do dance therapy. So I put her together with the Menninger Clinic, and Roy Menninger who was running it at the time, and he took a personal interest. I didn't have to pay him. They developed a book on it and a whole field of therapy, and she became a national figure, international really. So, I mean, that's the way I did it.
All right. Well, I mean, that's kind of, okay. All right, so basically, you were taking people who are out in their second careers or just starting their careers, and they wanted to open up their and expand on what they were doing. So you kind of hooked them up with local, you know, with local professors or local people who could teach them the ropes of what they needed to learn. So in effect, they were learning what they needed to learn. What kind of degrees were was available at your school?
Well, I redefined. I started out the whole program with a redefinition of what is a degree, and a degree, as I defined it, was a public announcement that this person has achieved the normally expected knowledge and skills associated with a particular discipline or skill or art or whatever it was, and then it was up to us to they had to prove. I started off the whole program with, all right, you're going to have to spend at least a year and maybe more with our school to get your degree, because we have to get to know that you really know what you say you know. And so how do you choose a major? You choose a major by saying what do you know now, and what would you like to know that you don't know? And so that's how we started with what we call the academic plan. The third part of it was, now how are you going to learn what you don't know? And that's when we needed the experts, because they would then guide these people to they sort of invented their own curriculum with the help of the experts. And so when they had to produce something that was tangible, like either a book or a thesis or a painting, or like in the case of the therapy, that she had a whole documented handbook of how you do dance therapy, and then that would be the basis for we bring in the external panel of professor of experts, and they would look at the product, and they would interrogate the student, and if they gave that person a pass, then that was the graduation. So we put all those people together about once a year, and we had a graduation.
Okay, now would you say they had a bachelor's degree, or how would you define the degree?
Yeah, this is all for a bachelor's degree.
It became, as we went along,
these people got into conventional graduate programs, and generally they knew more about their area of expertise than a lot of the teachers did. So they really breezed through the master's degree, and then when it came to doctorate, a number of them got doctors, but for them it was easy because it was exactly the same kind of thing that they had done to get their bachelor's degree.
Mm-hmm. All right, okay. So, you know, if somebody was to say to, say to you, here's what I'm getting from the experience you're talking about, because you're redefining education in the sense that, you know, people are learning what they want to learn, what they need to learn to progress. Now, most of these are all students who are adults, so they already have their life experience. They've had their share of life experiences. They're already working, and now they want to expand what they need to know. And so, in effect, you are tailoring that education to the individual.
Yep. That's what they call personalized education. And we, in the process, we invented what we called the portfolio method. But we told them they had to document what they already knew, and that was if they had transcripts from other colleges that they had gone to, if they had gone to professional education, if they had achieved a certain if they'd written something like a handbook or gotten awards for performance in the military. We had a lot of military people, particularly Air Force, because Richards Gebauer Air Force Base was just down the road.
Right.
So they had to put all that together into what we call the portfolio. And then that portfolio was evaluated by another external panel, usually three guys, sometimes only one, depending on what it was. And then they filled in the cracks and got the other stuff.
Yeah, hold on a second. This time, Dawson Files here on Bastion News Radio Network. We're listening to Dr. Larry, who's expounded upon the many things he has done in his life and the experiences he has and the experiences we can learn from those things. This is Tom Donaldson, The Donaldson Files.
You might know me. I'm 50 Cent. You may follow my tweets, my Facebook friends. Odds are a few in a 6 degrees separate us. We're that close. What's crazy is 1 in 6 don't know where their next meal is coming from. These are your coworkers, your neighbors, your friends. Hunger's too close for us to ignore. So visit feedingamerica.org/hunger and find your local food bank to see how you can make a difference. From one close friend to another, let's do this. I'm 50 Cent, and together we are Feeding America.
A message from Feeding America and the Ad Council.
I never get the flu.
My kids don't need more shots.
I don't have time.
We're all healthy.
My asthma's under control.
I'm pregnant.
I've had the flu. It's not a big deal.
My kids are too old
for flu. The media
is
exaggerating.
I can fight it naturally.
No matter how you build your excuses, the flu can blow your house down. Keep your foundation strong. Vaccinate. Learn more at flu.gov.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, back to the Donaldson Files here on the Bastion News Radio Network. Also, if you want to listen to this show, you can listen every day at 10 a.m. Central Time, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, or 3 p.m. Central Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time here on the BachelorNews.airtime.pro. Let me spell that bachelor for you. That's BATCHELOR News. So TheBachelorNews.airtime.pro. And don't forget tonight, following this show on this network, it's You and the Law, taking a look at a different perspective from two experienced police officers, two experienced police chiefs who talk about the perspective from both from a black and brown and people of color and how the law can work for them. You and the Law with those individuals. So stay tuned on this network. And plus you can listen to the repeats of those shows on the BastionNews.airtime.pro. And don't forget tomorrow night, the Donaldson Files will have the Wednesday Resistance Edition. We've got some special guests possibly coming on, so we'll surprise you at the 6 p.m. Eastern Time. And also, the Resistance Hour featuring Dr. Larry. Why don't you kind of tell everybody what's going on tomorrow night on the Resistance Hour?
Well, we have Ambassador Jim Gilmore, who is also a former governor of Virginia, who just spent the last 3 years as the American ambassador to the NATO Defense Council. And so he is, we're asking him to talk about the current foreign policy and what is good, what's bad, and so on. And then we also have former Congressman Bob Livingston, who was the Speaker of the House for a while and also the head of the budget committee that provided the last balanced budget in American history. And so he's going to talk more about what's happening in Washington and how does it relate to the rest of the story. So it's going to be a pretty interesting hour because these guys are real pros.
Absolutely. We've had them both on the show many times, so and they're worth always a listen. And for another, you know, first for the historical perspective, and plus in the case of Ambassador Gilmore, what he's already you know, he's not that far removed from the foreign policy apparatus. So that will be tomorrow night. All right. Okay, now, we talk about portfolio education, personalized education. I want to kind of move to some of your business side, because there's a lesson here to be learned, and that is sometimes opportunities present itself. And certainly your introduction to data control was, you know, somebody said, you know, this is the guy you got to talk to. You know, so somebody opened that door for you.
Yeah.
And you took advantage. So kind of talk a little bit about, you know, sometimes how, you know, doors can be open for you if you keep your eyes open. And also, in some ways, if you maintain friendship with people, even though if I remember the story correctly, as you just stated, he was a guy that you said you denied tenure? Oh, fired.
I fired
yeah.
him. I mean, I got him fired. I never could figure that out exactly, but he just—he was still loyal to me, even in spite of the fact that I reluctantly had to let him go because he just wasn't doing the job. So
maybe the point would be you may have also done him a favor, because obviously he moved on to somewhere else where he was successful and recommended you for that position.
Yeah. Well, and I guess one of the things I learned, or I guess I knew, was, you know, you never try to get ahead by stepping on the shoulders of the people that are around you. Just you know, try to be nice to everybody. You never know when somebody's going to turn out to be a real friend or help you in a... You may need him sometime, or you may have a chance to help him. I've always tried to be nice to people, and sometimes I haven't succeeded, but basically I try never to make any, even when you had to fire people, you know, you try to make it as humane as possible.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's an interesting point. The other thing that comes into play here is that it sounds like to me you kind of shaped that job, because they had you in Cleveland, and then you came to the conclusion you had to have some international, you know, they were asking you to do some international business. So you had to make some changes while on the job. So the question I'm going to throw back to you would be, is, okay, you know, like any business, you know, their opportunity presents itself. So how did you, in effect, make those changes and present those opportunities to others around you?
Well, I guess, you know, you have to be aware of the environment that you're in. And, I've always felt like the key to good management, it's to some extent the key to any kind of relationship, is to understand your own limitations and then to recruit to your weakness. If you're a good salesman but you're not very good at the financial side of things, then look for somebody that's really, you know, what you need is an accountant. You don't need another sales guy. And the same way in your personal relationships also, you shouldn't be crass about it, but when everybody that you talk to knows something that you don't know, and it's always better to listen than it is to talk. Now, that people that are hearing me tonight are going to say, you sure don't believe in that very strongly on Tom's radio show, but most of the time, you know, I ask questions rather than answer questions. You kind of got me on the other side right now.
Here's the point, because that's a very interesting part, because, you know, like I said, I work as a political, I run a political organization. I also pretty much am the project director for a foundation. And a lot of times when I go meet with donors or supporters, you know, I'll tell them very clearly. I said, look, I'm, you know, when I meet with my staff, I'm the dumbest guy in the room. And what I mean by that is, I hire people who know what they're doing, or I work with people who know what they're doing. They have, and I give them the authority to do what they need to do. But I also pick people who, quite frankly, and you've made a very interesting point. You make the point. You said, hire to your weakness. Hire people that can strengthen what it is you do, as opposed to, again, hire another salesman. But you basically say, okay, you hire people who can add to the company and add to your job. And I've been in that same position as well. And I always will say to people, look, I don't have any problems hiring people who are knowledgeable and things I'm not knowledgeable about. That's why I want to bring them on. One of the most important lessons in leadership that I've learned, and I'm going to ask you, I'm going to give you and want you to comment on this, is, I've had bosses that, quite frankly, would micromanage me. I mean, they literally would micromanage. And then I had bosses that would say, okay, give me your game plan, and then execute it. The one guy I had who was a micromanager was somebody said, why aren't you selling to this hospital here, doing this and doing this? And I said to him, well, for one thing, I could do that. But if you notice, while I may be losing 10% of my sales in this 10% of my business, the 40% over here, I'm up 40%. The 20% over here, I'm up 30%. And let me ask you this question, where do you want me to spend my time? On the other side of the equation, I remember starting the year, I had a rough 3 or 4 months right off the start of the year. I was looking at the data. I called my boss and I said, look, that business plan I sent you, I want to make some changes. I want to allocate my resources in this way. And he said to me, well, cool, that's a good idea. Then he said, don't worry, Tom, I've always got your back because I know you've been successful in the past, you'll be successful in the future. And I thought that I was in it because the second boss, I worked with this guy for years, for a couple of years, and he knew my strength, my talent, and he also knew that, and he was the kind of guy, I guess somebody say, boy, I made this mistake, now here's how I'm going to rectify it. He said, go do it. I trust you. And the one lesson to me that I've always come back with is this. On the micromanaging side of the equation, if I have to micromanage and do your job, in addition to being your manager, I hired the wrong person. Your thoughts?
Yeah, and you run into that a lot because people misrepresent themselves, and it's getting harder and harder to get a really truthful reference. It used to be you could call somebody that that used to work with a particular person, and you could say, what is he good at and what is he not so good at? You would get a truthful answer. I mean, maybe you'd ended up years later not agreeing with a guy, but he was telling you what he really thought. Nowadays, you call somebody, and they will just say, he worked for us, and he left, and he was here for this many years or months or whatever it was. And all you're getting is factual information that you could see from a vitae or something. And the reason that is because they're afraid of getting sued. So it's very hard to really find out exactly what somebody can do.
Okay, now you're also a farmer, and you have a horse farm.
Yes.
So let me put it this way. What lessons, what is about the farming you like? Is there a lesson dealing with farming, the horse farming, that let's say that you've learned? Is there anything you could sit back and say to people, here's what I learned, here's what I like?
Well, there's a lot to be learned. We recently had a change of personnel because my barn manager of 25 years retired, and my daughter took over, and she brought in all these young people. I mean, our staff now is is basically kids that are between about 17 and 22, and about half of the three or four of them really don't know much about horses, and they're taking the job to find out about horses. And what good is it to know about horses? That's definitely debatable. But one of the things I think that is very very apropos, and that is, you remember, horses don't really talk in language, and like we do. It's almost all body language. And if you learn how to read a horse's body language, you can essentially communicate with that horse, because he's watching you just like you're watching him. But that surprisingly translates very well to a lot of human situations, and you get used to watching people's reactions, physical reactions, just because you're used to watching horses. But it's amazing how much you can learn about people by just reading their body language. It's amazing how much they tell you, not by their words so much as it's just the way they sit, or the way they stand up, or the way the expression on their face, or their they got the guy who's continually moving out to try to get out of something, and that's one thing, and that's a small area, really. I think the big thing is that you get very related. You can, it's kind of like the same thing that you can get with a dog, or another pet, and that is, you get very attuned to another creature, and those creatures are not only different from us. They are a different species from us, and trying to cross species in some kind of communicative approach is really a challenge. But if you can master that, not only can you have a lot of fun, but you can also it's a different dimension to your life.
All right. Well, like I said, we're kind of running a little bit out of time. We're getting to the last 2 or 3 minutes. How did you get into horse farming to begin with? What inspired you to do that?
Well, I grew up on a farm, and my dad liked horses, so he got horses for us. Well, for all of us. And we had to... When I was 12 years old, I was breaking horses for riding under the direction of a riding master, but still I had to do the work. And I just grew up, loving horses, I guess. Then for 30 years I didn't touch a horse. And then my daughter came along one day and said, your Christmas present to me is going to be to teach me how to ride a horse. And so that began a whole new, I rediscovered horse riding.
That sounds good. I'm going to stop you right there. Yeah, this is Tom Donaldson, Donaldson Files. We're going to wrap this show up. Thank you very much, Dr. Larry, for joining us. Don't forget tomorrow, Donaldson Files, the Resistance Edition. In addition to, will be the Resistance Hour with Bob Livingston and with Ambassador James Gilmore. The Resistance Hour with Dr. Larry and Tom. This is Tom Donaldson saying good night.
To charges in an Elijah McClain case. Three officers and two paramedics indicted in the 2019 death of the young black man who died after being put in a chokehold while walking home from a convenience store. Marcus Moore has the latest. Good morning, Marcus.
Michael, good morning. These indictments come 2 years after Elijah McClain, who was unarmed, died following an altercation with police, and there had been loud calls for justice, and now comes this development.
This grainy body camera video captures portions of Elijah McClain's last moments alive. Police confronted the 23-year-old as he walked home alone from a grocery store 2 years ago. McClain died after a struggle with the officers. Now this morning, three policemen and two paramedics face criminal charges for the young man's death.
Our goal is to seek justice for Elijah McClain, for his family and friends, and for our state.
I've been praying for all of it. What I wanted, my son fought for his life, he died for his life.
The Colorado grand jury indictment detailing the 32 total counts levied against the officers and first responders, including manslaughter and criminally negligent homicide. On August 24, 2019, three Aurora police officers responded to a 911 call about a masked man acting suspiciously.
Hey, stop right there. Stop. Stop.
I have a right.
Stop. Stop. I have a right to stop you because you're being suspicious.
McClain's family later explained that he suffered from a blood condition that often made him feel cold.
Stop tensing up.
No, let go of me.
Stop tensing up.
No, I am an introvert. Please respect the boundaries that I am speaking.
Officers tackling McClain, then putting him in a carotid chokehold, which restricts blood flow to the brain. McClain pleading with them that he is nonviolent.
I'm so sorry. I have no gun. I don't do that stuff. I don't do
At one point, even crying out three words that have become rallying cries against police brutality. The officers later claiming that the 23-year-old had reached for one of their guns. And prosecutors say this was a critical moment. Paramedics arriving at the scene and injecting McClain with what prosecutors say was a lethal amount of the powerful anesthetic ketamine. The Aurora Police Association defending the officers, saying in a statement to ABC News, there is no evidence that APD officers caused his death. The hysterical overreaction to this case has severely damaged the police department.
This police department needs to be disbanded and rebuilt from the ground up.
McClain's death gained national attention during the months of protests following the police killing of George Floyd. Since then, Colorado has banned the use of chokeholds and bars paramedics from using ketamine to subdue suspects. Now McClain's family wants their son to be remembered as a gentle young man who had a bright future.
He was a giver. Giver of love, giver of whatever he can to make you feel better, even if he's not feeling good.
Family members also said that Elijah used to play the violin at the animal shelter, hoping they would not feel lonely. That's the kind of guy he was. And as we mentioned before, guys, there were calls, very loud calls for justice, and the family believes that these indictments are indeed a step to that end. Guys.
What a story that is. Tragic.
Hey, we want to welcome everyone to You and the Law podcast show on the Bachelor News Radio Network. We just listened to a recording from ABC News in reference to the Elijah McClain death that took place in 2019. And, Keith, I tell you, man, listen to this video over and over again, but to listen to it and to talk about it, so many things took place, so many wrong things took place with the police officers and this and Elijah on that night. And you know, Keith, for being as a police chief administrator, you got to do things that your city attorneys tell you not to do or not to say. But at some point, Keith, you just got to do the right thing. And 'cause me personally, Keith, I could not live with myself to say that these officers didn't do anything wrong that contributed to this young man's death. And to live with yourself knowing that you have to have known that these officers and paramedics played a significant role in this young man's death.
Well, I will tell you, Virgil, I think what happens is that people believe that I didn't pull the trigger, and that's so I didn't contribute. I think the entire stop from the beginning was questionable, and I think that the actions of all those individuals involved are questionable. You know, I just it's perplexing to me to understand why nobody sees that. I mean, why did you even approach the young man in the first place? I mean, I guess that's one of the things that you have to understand, that I want to understand.
Yeah. Well, and Keith, and you know, initially they said that someone called 911 saying that he was walking down the street and he looked suspicious. And even the officer says in the on the body cam footage that he was suspicious. We stopped you because you looked suspicious. I mean, so once again, how many times does a young black male or a young black female walking down the street, why do you have to look suspicious? And I think that's why so many people have been in such an outrage, because we got officers who know how to use certain language, and that certain language is going to be able to articulate what they do, and this is the reason that they did it. I mean, there's just no way around it. I mean, guys know how to say certain words, and they'll say, well, I said this here. Well, yeah, you did. You're right. And so, but here's a young man who went to the store to get his brother some iced tea, and he's walking back home. But days later, he dies from an apparent heart attack contributed by this here encounter with these officers. But Keith, one of the things that's really disturbing is the fact that they called the paramedics to inject him with this, if I'm pronouncing it right, ketamine.
I think that's correct.
Yeah. So when I have never in over 25 years in law enforcement ever heard of paramedics being called to inject a citizen with ketamine, and that this ketamine, you don't know what you're putting into somebody's body. And Keith, we're probably going to have some people listening to the show is going to say, well, this is why I don't want to take the vaccine, because I don't know what's in the vaccine. So how do you know what's in this ketamine? I mean, that was very disturbing to know that these guys, they specifically called the paramedics for them to inject him with this here ketamine.
Well, I will tell you, man, I just don't get it. I don't understand. I don't understand how you do that. And I guess I'm just trying to understand the reason for injecting this young man with something. And first time I ever heard of that was in this case. And I still,
well, me
still
too,
trying to figure out what was he doing that was so suspicious walking home from purchasing a drink for his brother. I mean, what was that? What was so suspicious about that?
Yeah. I mean, again, you just got these, you know, and I want our listeners to know, Keith, that, you know, this case is going to be tried in front of a jury. We're not trying to be the judge and the jury in this case. We're just talking about circumstances around this case and the fact that this is not the only case that has similarities to other things that have happened. But no matter what age you are, Keith, you should not lose your life. He was unarmed. He wasn't, they're saying he was being combative. But as you hear him say in the tape, Keith, I'm just different. But Keith, man, we're coming up on our first break, but we're going to take this break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to get into the conversation of the story behind the
Elijah McClain death in Aurora, Colorado, but you're listening to You and the Law on the Bachelor News Radio Network.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive's Employee of the Month, 2 months in a row. Leave a message at the...
Hi, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. I just had a new idea for our song about the Name Your Price tool. So when it's like, tell us what you want to pay, hey, 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 and the trombone goes, wah, 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 and you say, we'll help you find coverage options to fit your budget. Then we just all do finger snaps while a choir goes, savings coming at ya, savings coming at ya. Yes? No? Maybe? Anyway, see you at practice tonight. I got new lyrics for the rap break.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Every day.
Sally Beauty's new all-in-one hair color kits make it easy to color your hair at home. Get everything you need to color for beautifully radiant results. Loved by professionals, open to everyone. Sally Beauty.
Blog Talk.
Welcome to You and the Law on the Best of News Radio Network, WCLM in Chapel Hill, and of course, IBM TV, Big Mind Entertainment. This is the You and the Law broadcast with Chief Keith Humphrey, Chief Virgil Green. If you have a question, you can hit us up in the chat room. You can listen or ask questions at 646-929-0130, or listen live at our website, thebachelornews.airtime.com. With that, go back to the Chiefs in charge, Chief Keith Humphrey and Chief Virgil Green.
Well, hey, Chief, you know, we're talking about the recent charges that have came down that involves the officers and paramedics in the Elijah McClain's death that occurred in 2019 in Aurora, Colorado. So, recently, the grand jury handed down a 32-count indictment that involves the three police officers and, I believe, two paramedics. And, you know, Keith, I think this when this young man's death occurred, not a lot of people really knew about Elijah McClain until the incident happened with George Floyd. And then people started talking about Elijah McClain, but the prosecutor in the case, Keith, basically said that there wasn't any evidence due to the fact that the autopsy could not determine the manner of death, that he was not filing any charges against the police officer. But so you had multiple investigations behind this here, and it actually took the governor of Colorado to step in and to order the district attorney to open up a new criminal investigation.
You know, I don't get what the hesitation is to do that. It's the right thing to do. I don't get what that hesitation is. I mean, when someone loses their life while in custody of law enforcement, man, that's serious. And even if it was a, I don't like to say justified, but even if they determined that there was reason for the force to be used, that's still investigated. Those cases still need to go before a grand jury or the prosecuting attorney. We're not in a position these days to say, well, it looks fine. We're not going to look into it. It's closed. It's a closed deal. It was justified. Let's move forward. We're not in that position mm-hmm. anymore. And so for them to say that, you know, it comes down to, I thought of the Breonna Taylor situation where you had the prosecuting attorney just outright left out information to the grand jury. Mm-hmm. The situation in Georgia, the suburb of Georgia, the young man the young man was just walking, running through the neighborhood, and he was attacked by two guys. And, you know, the prosecutor there didn't want to, tried to hide the case. And then passed it on to another prosecutor, and then tried to figure out, okay, how can we keep this from going to trial or whatever.
I mean, what's up with that, man? Why do people think that that's right?
Well, and you know, Keith, and I think this is the thing. people, there's definitely some entitlement, and you know, and it's sad to say that, Keith, because we're in law enforcement, and the fact that, for me, Keith, you just have to acknowledge the facts. You can't sugarcoat it. You can't kind of, you know, say, well, but when you look at every single thing, there are some entitlements, and some people will not agree with what I just said. But at the end of the day, when you're talking about when a young man loses his life because he was walking home from a store at night in the cold, had on a ski mask, and he has obviously a medical issue that the reason why he's wearing this type of ski mask, but he's not bothering anybody. But you feel that you got to make up a reason to justify why you stopped him and to question him. But one of the things that came out in one of these investigations, Keith, is that the Attorney General's office conducted a civil rights investigation into the agency. So one of the things that came out is that they were very critical of this agency because there was no evidence to justify the officer stopping this young man as he walked home. So, again, you've got another law enforcement agency, the highest law enforcement agency in your state, who is very critical and says there's no evidence to support why you are – there's no evidence that justified why you stopped this young man as he was walking home. So, again, you got police officers who feel like, well, hey, you walking down the street, this is my city street. Again, you've heard that term before, right, Keith? My city street, this is my street, so I got the right to stop you. No, you don't.
You know, Virgil, it goes back to the badge having a lot of authority. And, you know, when you put that authority with egos and arrogance, you know, that can happen. And we're talking about any police officer. We talk about officers, not all police officers, but we're talking about it doesn't matter what that officer looks like. The badge is heavy. The cockiness is heavy. And the fact that you do what I say and nobody will get hurt or you do what I say and that's it, period, point blank. But when does it become against the law for a young man to walk in his cold, for him to have a mask on, or, you know, when they sell those things? And, you know, could you get out and talk to him, say, hey, where you going? Everything okay? Absolutely. But, you know, this is a young man that had some form of mental illness. And that's not against the law to be mentally ill or to have a learning disorder or to be, you know, handicapped. Disabled.
Yeah, disabled. Yeah. He called himself a introvert.
Yeah, that's not against the law.
Yeah.
You know, that's not against the law. And we got to stop standing behind this where they look different or – you know, I fear for my safety or, you know, it's, you look out of place or, you know, you just didn't look right. Something just look right. You know, why not just ask the young man? I don't have a problem with you talking to the young man. Hey, man, what's going on? You know, it said pretty good. I picked up something for my brother to drink or whatever. I'm on my way back from the store.
Yeah.
And just going home. Okay, man, you need anything? All right. We just sometimes you have those officers that just feel like they have to do something. They have to stay busy. They can't allow people to go on about their business. They feel as though if they do that, and this is what I've heard a lot of times, but what if he just robbed a store, or what if he's going to rob a store? Well, I mean, how many people do you stop out here that might have that intention that you never know about? So you can't always continue to use that as a this job isn't hard. This job isn't difficult at all. It's really not that difficult to do the right thing. It's not that
difficult. But you can make it difficult.
Common sense. You can make it extremely difficult when you don't want to be flexible and you feel as though you have to win all the time.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Well, hey, Keith, I want to remind our listeners, if you're just now tuning into the show, the chat room is open at blogtalkradio.com/LA Bachelor. The producer is screening calls. If you've got a comment, if you want to come on air, do so, or if you want to just send a message in the chat room about the topic that we're talking about, the story of Elijah McClain, please do so, or come on the air and talk to us and let us know what's on your mind about this topic. Keith, it's just, you know, there was an incident that happened back in, Irving, Texas, in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, either last year or year before last, that we talked about on the podcast, where a young man was walking home from work. It was snowing.
Plano.
And walking home in the snow. And that incident went way south real quick just because of the officer's aggressive attitude toward this young man. And he clearly told him, I'm fine. I don't need y'all. I don't need you. Leave me alone. But you got these guys, well, no, we just want to check on you, make sure. When somebody tells you they're fine, leave them alone, and you can see that they're walking down the street, they're not under the influence, I'm just going to say, well, sir, you have a good night, and hopefully you get home safely.
How do you know they're not under influence? How do you know they haven't done anything? I'm playing devil's advocate. I'm just saying the way some of these officers think.
So again, you're going to have guys say, well, how do you know that they're not under the influence? Well, okay, you went through all this here training to give you the ability to determine if this person shows any signs that they are under the influence of alcohol. So when guys sit there and say, well, I didn't know and I had to do this and I didn't know they – you. And again, Keith, you got guys who say, well, it's a law that you got to show me your ID. So the average citizen will say, I don't even have my ID on me. So how am I going to show you something that I don't have?
Well, I had one like this in one of my previous departments, and a guy was jogging, and the officer questioned, this man was actually jogging. He had actually left his house, and his wife was staying with the baby who had been sick and had, you know, been crying all day. And so the wife decided once she got the baby down for a nap, she was going to take her a sleeping pill and go to sleep. Now he's running, and the officer stops him and tells him he's got to get in the back of the car, and then starts questioning him about, the guy's telling him, I live around the corner, I'm just out jogging, why are you out here jogging this time of night? Does your wife know you're out? You know, I just live right around the corner. Well, what's your name? Gives him his name. Have you ever had a ticket? I said, man, I can't remember. I may have had one a few years ago. Well, why wouldn't you know the specific date you had a ticket? I mean, I can tell you every ticket I've gotten. Why wouldn't you know when you got a ticket? And it kind of went downhill from there.
Mm-hmm.
And he took the guy home. So legally, that guy was detained. That guy was not free to go. So, you know, you talk about detention or you talk about arrest, that guy was not free to go. And he pulls up in front of the guy's house and knocks on the door. He's told the officer that the wife's out. We got to take a break, Bernie?
Yeah, Keith. So
yeah, okay.
Let us take
I'll
this break
and finish it. Yeah, I'll finish it when we come back.
Okay. Well, hey, we're going to take this break, but you're listening to You and the Law on the Bachelor News Radio Network.
Dermarest, the psoriasis solution, asks,
what's complete freedom? For me, it's an open road with the top down. It's my bare arms getting warmed by the sun. It's my bare arms without a trace of psoriasis.
Complete freedom, brought to you by the complete relief of Dermarest psoriasis. Unlike brands which only relieve itching and inflammation, Dermarest psoriasis also removes the embarrassing scales, allowing healthy skin to grow.
Healthy skin? That's complete freedom.
Dermarest, the psoriasis solution.
Welcome back to the You and the Law broadcast on the Bachelor News Radio Network. Of course, you can listen live at bachelornews.airtime.pro, or you can listen at 646-929-0130. Chat room is open as well. I've had a couple questions come in. Actually, one comment. Steve in Texas said, with these repeat offenders in terms of law enforcement agencies like Aurora, what does people expect? He put in parentheses, the two of you included. What do you expect? I got an email from someone who's disabled that says that disabled Americans are at the bottom of the totem pole when it comes to equal rights, justice, and their dealings with police. Back to you.
Well, hey, Keith, we definitely want to thank Steve in Texas for listening and for the other caller, for the other listener who sent an email about people with disabilities. But, Keith, you were, before the break, you had was talking about a situation that happened.
Yeah. And for over an hour, he's got this man in his car. And for of that hour, about 20 minutes, he's sitting out in front of this man's house, berating this man because this man doesn't have his ID, because this man, he knocks on the door, the wife doesn't come to the door, and he starts berating the man's wife, basically what type of mother is she, taking a sleeping pill and got a young baby, and, you know, and you're out here doing, you know, God knows what. And finally, after an hour, the man wants a supervisor. Supervisor comes over there, and it was bad. And so, you know, my thing is that when do you, you know, is it not all right for a person to jog? Is it not all right for a person to, and I get it, you know, suspicious activity, but what's suspicious? I think sometimes it's very subjective. I think it's subjective. I think sometimes we use that as a crutch, you know,
Keith, and it's also too broad.
It's very broad, Virgil, and I will tell you that I've arrested suspicious people before, you know, coming out of a dark alley, 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, with dark clothing on and shining a flashlight. I think people understand that.
Mm-hmm.
I arrest a lot of people just walking down the street. You know, you get somebody had a lot of rash of vehicle burglaries, and you get a person, you know, hoodie on, carrying a black bag or carrying a car radio. I think you have a right to stop and talk to that person and determine what's going on. But you know, we got to use common sense. Sometimes you just don't have a reason to stop somebody. And, you know, I want to answer Steve's question, but to answer the gentleman that talked about disabilities, he's absolutely right. We've got to do a better job of being able to relate or recognizing individuals that have disabilities you know, having resources in place and getting to be better partners with our community that suffer from some type of disability. I can't argue with that. I won't try to argue with that or justify our actions in that, but we do have to do a better job of that. And sir, for that, as a police chief, I want to apologize to enforcement as a whole. Now, I think we've come farther than we are, because there are some resources out there that help us to address the needs of our community that are disabled. But we can do a better job. We really can do a better job.
Well, and you know, Keith, and I'm going to say this. You want to be positive, and you want to try to find just a slight light of hope or positive to say about a situation. This situation right here, Keith, when you know, we're talking about people with disabilities. You know, clearly when you talk to this, you're talking to this young man, it shouldn't have taken them that long to understand that he's a little different. And when somebody tells you that they're an introvert, this young man was quiet. He says, hey, I'm an introvert. Automatically, Keith, with me, I'm going to sit there and kind of like, okay, so...
Well, you can't make a person talk to you, Virgil.
You can't make a, and that's just the simple fact. You can't make people talk to you, but these officers wanted to physically force this young man to talk to them, to tell them where he was going, why he was looking suspicious. But, Keith, I'm going to go back to when you look at this young man's picture, and our listeners encourage you to just Google Elijah McClain and look at this young man's picture. His picture is on our You and the Law Facebook page. Just look at this young man, and there is nothing about him that you would feel like he is a threat. And when you hear this young man pleading that he can't breathe, Keith, that,
right,
you know, he's sobbing, he's crying, and when you look at his picture, I'm going back to reflecting on when former President Obama said about Trayvon
Martin.
Hey, he could have been my son. Well, this Elijah McClain could have been easily one, your son or my son, walking down the street. He's 140 pounds, Keith. And I just found where it was – they used 6.5 kilograms of this, what is it, Keatman, in his body.
Yeah. Just say the K drug.
The K drug, or the K shot. Now, which, Keith, this was one and a half times the dose for his weight. So even the paramedics, and I think that's why the paramedics have been charged in this here, because they should have known that this is not something that they should have used. They should have told the officers, no, we're not going to administer this to this young man. But then the fire department in Aurora, Colorado, they are allowed to use this drug to sedate combative or aggressive people. So just think about that, our listeners. The fire department has the ability, the authority to use this drug to sedate a combative or aggressive person. Well, an officer can articulate and say, well, hey, you being combative or you being aggressive, so we're just going to call the fire department out, and they're going to shoot you up with the K shot, so we ain't really got to deal with you. I mean, Keith, I mean, when do you have the authority to just take control of another person's body? And so,
well,
they ended up shooting. So they used this. They overdosed him with this stuff. He is in a coma for the next 6 days, and they take him off of life support. So, again, Keith, they're just – and I think, you know – this case happened in 2019, but they just – so why did it take – again, you got so many people who asked me, why did it take them 2 years to finally get an indictment? But
well, you know what, Virgil, I think every state is different. I think every state is different, and I don't want to jump to conclusions that they stalled on it. I want to give the benefit of the doubt that it was the investigation took this long, which that doesn't make a family feel any better, because the family's still trying to understand, you know, what happened in the community. What I will tell you is that, you know, one of the things that I want to clarify to the listeners, we're not saying that someone who weighs 140 pounds can't be combative and can't hurt you. We're not saying that at all. But what we are saying is you just can't walk up to people because they look a certain way and have an encounter with them. The law is very, very clear. When you don't have reasonable suspicion or probable cause to stop someone, a person does not have to identify themselves. If you can say all day, hey, my name is Keith and my name is Virgil, what's yours? And if that person says, I don't want to give you my name, that person didn't do anything wrong. You know, my thing is, I don't know every fact of it, but from what I gather, this young man was just walking home. Okay, he's got a mask on. Well, it's cold outside. Is that uncommon for someone to wear one of those ski masks? Is that uncommon? You know, we faced the same questions when the pandemic started, and you were going to have individuals with masks on. Does that mean that because someone has a mask and you can only see their eyes, does that mean that they are going to, you know, do some damage or, you know, commit a crime? No, it doesn't mean it. I think we've got to find out or determine what's that line. You know, where's that line drawn? You know, when do we understand that we can't just take a person's freedom, or we can't just detain somebody? When do we understand that, you know, I'm trying not to armchair quarterback, but when this young man is telling you he's an introvert and you're saying you're doing a welfare check, what would have been wrong with contacting his relatives and say, hey, we've got, you know, we've got your son.
We got Elijah.
We got Elijah out here. And, you know, what's going on with him? We were kind of concerned. He's out here in the cold. Is he okay? I think you could have done that. Try not to second guess those officers. But I just think that, you know, you're hearing more and more of this story. The situation in Plano, I get it. You got a young man walking in his ice, and he's walking in shorts and a T-shirt. I get it. There's nothing wrong with doing a welfare check, but when somebody tells you, I'm okay, I'm just walking home, I think there has been pressure throughout the history of this profession from supervisors and from chiefs of police to basically, we have scared these officers to thinking, if I don't make contact with a person, if I don't detain a person, if I don't find out more about this individual, and I find out later on that this person was involved in a crime, then I'm in trouble. So we have caused a lot of fear in this organization. We've caused a lot of fear.
Well, Keith, and I'm gonna say this. I think when officers, if they have that mentality or that attitude, I mean, you're right. But at the same time, you got to use some common sense. And you know, at the end of the day, you know, you're a man just like this other person that you're dealing with. And when another man tells you, hey, I'm cool, I'm straight, I'm all right, you need to just go ahead and leave me alone. But be a man and just walk away and leave him alone. Again, you know, I think some guys, they carry things too far. And as we've seen, Keith, people end up dying and families are dealing with everything that they've got to deal with because of this action of a police officer. But Keith, we're coming up and we're going to take this break, but when we come back, we're going to get back into the conversation of the story behind Elijah McClain, who died in 2019 in Aurora, Colorado. But you're listening to You and the Law on the Bachelor News Radio Network.
This is Chicago-style hot dog here. I'm not feeling too good. Turns out, along with all the other bad things my cholesterol does, they say it's a risk factor for strokes. Strokes? Sheesh! Good news from National Stroke Association. Exercising, eating right, and asking your doctor about medicines that can help lower your cholesterol, like statins, may reduce the risk of a first stroke. And if you've already had a stroke, it's even more important you lower your cholesterol.
Lower your chances of stroke by controlling your cholesterol. Visit stroke.org today.
If you're an African American man, you need to know about oral cancer. Oral cancer is more common in African American men than in any other group in the U.S. If you have a sore or lump in your mouth that doesn't go away after 2 weeks, see a doctor or a dentist. Most often these symptoms don't mean cancer, but it's important to get them checked. If you do have oral cancer, it can be treated more successfully if it's caught early. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, National Institutes of Health.
Welcome back to You and the Law broadcast on the Bachelor News Radio Network. You listen live at TheBachelorNews.airtime.pro, TheBachelorNews.airtime.pro, and of course, dial in before they end at 646-929-0130. Get in touch with Chief Keith Huffley, Chief Virgil Green. Back to you guys.
Hey, Keith. You know, we had two comments earlier from our listeners, and one of the comments, or probably a question, was about this whole situation that took place in Aurora, Colorado, and the fact that, you know, it's just not Aurora, but many other cities that these things have happened to or have occurred.
Real quick, Virgil, I think what they meant was, excuse me, that Aurora's had an issue in the past. So repeat offender, they're saying people should not be, including you guys, yes, that's what they put in parentheses, should not be surprised.
Well, yeah, and that's what I was, and I was going to get to that point that, you know, this agency is this isn't the first time that they've had, they've been in the negative spotlight in their community. And the fact that you've got, you know, individuals who don't want to come out and publicly just, if it's, you know, Keith, I have to say this, if it's wrong, it's wrong. I mean, I don't see how you, as a police chief, you've got an agency that you're leading. You've got a lot of people who don't want you to say certain things. You've got people who do want you to say certain things. But when you've had an agency who has had a pattern of racial profiling in the community, especially in the black community, and these things continue to happen, and the people who live in this city don't see any changes, you just can't keep sugarcoating it and trying to put a Band-Aid on it and say, yeah, we're in the community, we're doing this, but the people who live in that community, they don't see that. And by all accounts, when outside agencies have looked at this agency, they have seen a clear pattern of racial profiling, police officers' excess use of force. So, again, these agencies really need to clean up their act, and because it's the community that they're suffering.
Well, let me say this, Virgil. One of the things I want to share with the listeners is that the policies, the roadmap, the foundation, and the roadmap are there. As far as every department has policies, I'm going to say sometimes. Well, I'm going to ask a question, Virgil. Is it always the department? Is it always the policies, or can it sometimes be that individual? And then if it comes back to it's that individual, then it comes back to, well, when did they know? When did they see a pattern? And then when you find out there was a pattern, then how did that pattern go unnoticed, or how did it go untouched? Those are the questions. It doesn't necessarily mean the policies aren't there. It means the fact that somewhere that officer got comfortable performing their duties. It's like Chauvin. Chauvin had a history. Why was Chauvin still there? Did somebody turn a blind eye? Did, you know, because you heard all these stories during his trial that this is not new, this doesn't surprise us. Well, that's a problem in itself right there. It's too late when something like this occurs, and then officers or the department wants to get on the stand and they want to say, well, yeah, this person had that reputation, or yeah, this person in training, this person, we were notified of this. It's too late then. And so is it always the department as a whole? And I get it, to the citizens, the everybody on the department represents the department. The chief is held accountable for the actions of his officers, and he should. And so I just want to make sure that citizens know that you can't always blame it. The listeners know it's not always the department. It's not always the policies. It's sometimes that you just have those individuals that have those character flaws. But then it goes back to, when did you know it? Because, like I said, it's too late after 18 allegations. It's too late after someone's life or someone's been injured or another officer has been injured at the based on the poor actions of an officer. It's too late. So this type of behavior is not new. When did these paramedics do this? This is not the first time, like you said, it happened. So why did they continue to do that? Why did they continue to do that? Why would they continue to practice in that manner? Why were the officers allowed to? So that's the bigger question. What made them feel comfortable doing that?
Yeah. Well, Keith, and you know, another thing that just came down in the past week that I want our listeners to know is that the Colorado Attorney General office is forcing the Aurora Police Department to put in reforms because under their investigation, they saw a pattern of racial bias and excessive force. And so, you know, if I'm the police chief of this agency and you've been there for years, how is it that you don't know that these things are going on in your agency? And then all of a sudden, Keith, when it leads to the death of a 23-year-old, and now you've got top law enforcement agency in your state is forcing you to make changes within your police department, and also he is seeking a consent decree with the department to outline steps to fix these problems. And so, you know, again, at some point, there is some complacency that has happened to where I can't say anything about it. If I say anything about it, I got the union guys against me. If I say anything about it, I got the council people against me. If I say anything about it, I may lose my job. But at the end of the day, you know, you've got to do what's right. And I think if you're any kind of a man, Keith, that you go home and you are watching the news in your city, and you see this video of this 23-year-old who is pleading for his life, who is telling the officer that he cannot breathe. And
that's the thing right there.
It's frustrating.
Yeah. Because you know what? Because you know what, Virgil, after 33 years, I can actually say when I was a young officer, I've heard people not necessarily say they couldn't breathe, but they had to use the restroom or the cuffs were too tight. And I've heard officers say, man, you're just trying to stall. We don't take, and that's where it comes down to this humanity thing. It comes down to the point of everybody's not lying. I get it. I get there are people that play the game and they want to prolong their trip to jail and they don't. You know, I get that. I mean, we've seen that. I mean, there's been officers killed, you know, by this kind of behavior. I get it. I totally get it. But there's ways to handle that. But it's like we said before. You have to put a human side to it. And it comes down to, you know, people want to say, well, the chief this, the chief that. There are just some things the chief doesn't know. You put your trust and your faith in your supervisors that they will address these things appropriately. I will say that we have a good early intervention process here, and where it comes up, I am notified that there is someone that's received these alerts based on certain behavior, not always negative behavior, but there's thresholds. So I'm saying this person's saying I can't breathe. This person's walking down the street. You've detained this individual. This individual, if he's an introvert, or just say, what if this person had a form of autism or something like that, and they don't like to be touched, or they feel intimidated when there's crowds. I mean, everybody's different, and so what I'm saying is we got to learn how to deal with that in law enforcement. We've got to learn that we can't control every situation, or we can't control everyone, and that's okay to not be able to do that. It's okay. It's okay to let people walk. It's okay to let people go. It's okay. That's okay if everybody doesn't speak to us when we speak to them. That's okay. We've got to start thinking that because we wear a badge, we're always right or we're in control.
Yeah. Well, hey, Keith, I want to get to this comment before I get to the other listener's comment about the people with disabilities. But we've got somebody who's listening to the show. Definitely thank you for listening to you and the law. But he says that suspicious characters should be stopped for the protection of society. Then he goes on to say that you guys never talk about officer-involved shootings, wounded, or killed by perps. Now, to the listener, you don't have to believe me. That's not true, but... To this listener, if you don't have to believe me, but I just want you to, it sounds you're an intelligent person. Google and ask yourself the question: is there a law that says you have to identify yourself to the police? There is no U.S. federal law requiring that an individual has to identify them or themselves to the police during a Terry stop. No law. There's not even a municipality doesn't have a law that says the officer has the authority to stop. You can stop a person, but that person is not required by federal law to identify themselves to a police officer. So,
and if you
that's
stop,
not something
if you
that we
stop them, and if you stop them for reasonable suspicion or for probable cause, they do identify themselves. It has to be they have to be truthful about who they are, but they don't have to tell you anything. You can't make a person talk to you. A person doesn't have to tell you. Yeah, they should, but they don't have to talk to you. And once a person says, "I'm not going to talk to you," then you move on and determine what other methods you can take. But this thing about you will talk to me and this, that, and other, man, that is a That's dangerous. Yeah, I do believe suspicious activity. But let me ask you this. What is suspicious?
Yeah.
I'm doing my walk at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, listening to my radio. Is that suspicious? Is pulling up on car doors or looking in cars at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, is that suspicious? Absolutely. But me just walking down the street, 2 o'clock in the morning, does that mean that's suspicious? I mean, you can speak to me and let me know you're there, but that doesn't mean I'm doing anything wrong.
Yeah. Well, Keith, and this whole thing with Elijah McClain, it all initiated from a person that these officers don't know who called 911 and said, hey, there's this suspicious man walking down the street and he's got on a mask. Okay, well, there again, you've had so many people who have just called into the police with false information, and that false information has led to the death of individuals. So just like with this situation, this person said, oh, he looked suspicious. Then the officer said, well, you are suspicious. You're walking down the street and whatever. And it led to the death of a 23-year-old. So I want to add, you know, the person who just made this comment about, you know, officers, you know, need to be able to do that. This young man did not deserve to die. He did not deserve to die. All he was doing was walking. He walked to the store. He should have had that same freedom to walk back home without fearing to have anything happen to him. And Keith, we're coming up on the last few minutes of the show, but oftentimes, Keith, people have the attitude and they'll say exactly what this person is saying, but let this same thing happen to one of their family members is the total opposite. So,
Virgil, let me say this. We do talk about officers have been injured. We talk about their families. As a matter of fact, we talked last week about the number of officers that have died
from COVID,
complications of COVID, and basically we talked about that it's outnumbered the number of officers who've been shot and killed. We always honor our people, but I always honor people, officers who've been killed in line of duty. Matter of fact, a Houston officer was killed yesterday. By a violent suspect who had been arrested 18 times. That's a problem. When they went out, that man put his life on the line, 31-year veteran, wife recently retired from the department. He was killed by someone who didn't value life. So we do talk about those things. We are talking about police officers who believe that they have to address every issue they see. They have to stop everybody. We're not talking about the actual suspicious activity. It's not suspicious. That young man wasn't doing it. That young man basically was contacted because somebody, whomever, said he looked suspicious. That's what it is. It's not against the law to dress a certain way. It's not against the law.
Yeah.
It's just
so let me ask you this question.
It's frustrating that we have to have this conversation.
Yeah. So he was not suspicious when he walked to the store, but he was suspicious as he walked back home. That doesn't make any sense. So, you know, this whole thing, you know, it's good to see that the criminal justice system is going to hold these individuals accountable under this 32-count indictment. And hopefully
the
family
Virgil,
will.
Hey, Virgil, let me just say this. And they may be found not guilty. So,
well,
so
you're absolutely
being
right.
Nobody's being judged. We're just saying basically what I have, they came back with an indictment. They still have to go to trial. They haven't been found guilty of anything.
Yeah, exactly.
And we never say
Keith,
we never say they did.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, hey, man, it's been a great show. And, you know, I want to let our listeners know that if you want to know more about Chief Swag and You and the Law podcast show, go to our Facebook page at You and the Law 1 on Facebook. Like us, follow us. But And make sure you tune in next Tuesday for another great episode of You and the Law. But you're listening to You and the Law on the Bachelor News Radio Network.